Every operation, a case officer planned and carried out a surveillance detection run. Rolf wanted to be absolutely certain he was free from KGB surveillance. With help from the other case officers and the technical operations team in the station, he worked up a plan. It was far more ambitious than usual, and based on something Gilshire had once attempted unsuccessfully. Rolf went over it, minute by minute, with Gerber, who pressed him about every possible fault. What happens if... What happens if... Finally, the chief was satisfied. Rolf bought a round-trip ticket on the Soviet airline Aeroflot from Moscow to Frankfurt, with a Friday departure and a return the following Thursday. He properly notified the Soviet administrative office, which provided services to diplomats, that he was coming back on Thursday, confident they would report it to the KGB. Then he packed his bag and caught the flight out. From Frankfurt, Rolf took a train to Vienna on Saturday. He was so filled with anxiety he could hardly sleep. On Monday, he went to the airport and, for cash, bought a one-way air ticket back to Moscow on the next Austrian Airlines flight. The KGB was expecting him to return on Thursday on Aeroflot. Once he landed on Monday afternoon, he went through passport control, but he knew it would take them a while to report his arrival to the KGB. This was the gap he was trying to exploit, a simple lapse in bureaucracy that would give him a few hours. He was black, free from surveillance. At the time he landed in Moscow, the wife of another case officer was bringing a small duffel bag to Rolf's wife, who was a teacher. As Rolf's wife finished her classes, she took the duffel bag and began her own surveillance detection run through the city by car. The bag held a light disguise for Rolf, an ops note, and CIA questions to be given to Shymov. From the airport, Rolf took a taxi toward the city. He abruptly got out at a busy metro stop, Dynamo, about halfway into town. The stop was on one side of the broad Leningradsky Prospect. Rolf walked, casually, around the metro stop and then toward a building marked Aeroflot on the other side of the highway, all the while looking for possible surveillance. When he reached the building, his wife picked him up in the car. They began another long surveillance detection run. Finally, satisfied that he was completely free from surveillance and having put on the disguise, Rolf got out of the car. His wife sped off for a few hours to a planned dinner party with friends. By 8 p.m., Rolf was walking near a statue of Alexander Griboyedov, a Russian playwright and diplomat who was killed by an angry mob in Tehran while serving as ambassador to Persia in 1829. The statue stood high on a pedestal near the Kirovskaya metro station at Chistyaprudy, a broad tree-lined park with a boulevard on each side in an old section of Moscow, filled with narrow lanes and a maze of passageways. Rolf was near the statue when he saw the man he was looking for, carrying a magazine, approaching from the metro. Rolf spoke first.
Viktor Ivanovich?
Yes.
Good evening. I am Misha.
Rolf extended his hand. Shymov shook it, but he told himself it was important to establish that this man was really an American intelligence officer. He might be walking into a trap. They started walking. Both were in their early 30s. Rolf saw that Shymov's face was smooth, clean, boyish. He wore a military-style cap. Shymov thought Rolf spoke Russian with an accent, although it didn't necessarily seem to be an American one. Shymov noticed that Rolf didn't wear gloves. A Russian would. Physically, Rolf was coiled, thinking that any second the Klieg lights would come on, the KGB officers would spring from the bushes, and he and Shymov would be ambushed. Shymov had taken a roundabout subway route to avoid surveillance, but he was also worried and tense. He knew more than Rolf did about how the KGB worked, that they used floating surveillance teams, which roamed the city and could appear randomly. He noted a nearby phone booth was empty. At least that was a good sign. Both men had been trained to carry out operations with a basic principle. Once it begins, don't think about it. Both knew that their business was to spend hours and hours planning, but in execution, an operation would be brief and had to be flawless. The metaphor in Rolf's mind was of an actor stepping on the stage. Once the curtain came up, you just did your best to perform. Shymov believed the worst thing an intelligence professional could do would be to give in to fear. That meant losing control.
"You might be KGB," Shymov said to Rolf.
"I can't be KGB. I speak Russian with an accent," Rolf protested.
"Okay, but they can speak Russian with an accent too," Shymov said.
The two men walked through the park, away from the metro and the statue. Darkness enveloped them. They kept quizzing each other, both looking for any sign of trouble. Shymov repeated that he wanted to be exfiltrated with his family. Rolf responded that it was a tall order and might take 12 to 18 months to prepare. He told Shymov that he would have to provide some information first. Rolf thought they might meet again in a month or two, but Shymov said, why wait? He would be ready in a week. Shymov insisted that they meet in person. He did not want to communicate with the Americans by dead drop. He told Rolf that KGB counterintelligence had made a long list of people arrested for working with spies, caught in a dead drop, caught using a radio. No one had been caught in a personal meeting. Shymov wanted to see his CIA case officer face to face. Rolf agreed. They parted, and Rolf took a metro a few stops toward the center of Moscow. His wife picked him up in the car, and they headed home. The next morning, everyone crowded around Gerber's conference table to hear what had happened. Rolf thought he might have a month to prepare for the next meeting, but now he had only a week. He surmised that the KGB had figured out his trick of going abroad and returning home early, so he could not repeat it. The Moscow station created an elaborate plan for the next meeting. Rolf would be the primary case officer. But if he came under KGB surveillance, there would be a second and a third officer nearby on the streets, having completed their own surveillance detection runs, ready to slip into his place, just in case. They did a month's work in just a few days. As it turned out, Rolf was clear. The meeting began without trouble. Rolf asked Shymov some questions from headquarters about complex mathematics and cryptology, and Shymov answered into Rolf's small tape recorder. They again discussed exfiltration. Shymov wanted $1 million upon his arrival in the United States, immediate citizenship, and lifetime health benefits for his family. Rolf didn't make any promises. He asked Shymov for mundane but essential details about his family, clothing sizes, medical histories, weights, and shoe sizes. And he needed recent photographs of everyone for the new identity documents they would get after exfiltration on the other side. At one of the first meetings, Rolf gave Shymov the CIA's miniature Tropel cameras. Rolf said to him,
"Photograph the most highly classified papers you have. Don't take chances with other people around. But you have to prove to us that you are who you say you are."
Shymov agreed. He returned the cameras with exposed film and was given a fresh supply. Shymov suggested the CIA fake the drowning of his family in a river so the KGB would not suspect they had defected. Rolf responded that the CIA and Shymov had more important things to do, to ensure the actual exfiltration was a success. In fact, Rolf had given plenty of thought to what would happen once Shymov and his family vanished. Inside the Moscow station, Rolf discussed how to make Shymov disappear without a trace. They would leave the apartment exactly as it was, a cup of tea unfinished on the table, the bed unmade, a newspaper open, their clothes still in the closets. They talked about whether the disappearance could be explained as a drowning, but Rolf and the other case officers didn't dwell on it. That was not something they could plan. He would just have to play out. The KGB would probably be much more inclined to blame an accident or crime, and it might be quite a while before they realized Shymov had defected. Rolf and Shymov were walking down one of the narrow lanes in Moscow when they saw them at the same moment. The nightmare scenario. Two men in a playground sandbox. They could be anybody. But both intelligence officers instantly thought surveillance. The narrow streets left them few escape routes, and if it were really the KGB, they would be boxed in at both ends of the street. As they got closer, Shymov sensed they were not KGB, but perhaps militiamen. Crude, jumpy, capable of demanding papers, but not as threatening. Shymov went over and asked one for a match. Then, after returning to Rolf, as they passed the two men, Shymov berated Rolf as if they were having a family argument. His outburst carried them well past the men. Shymov noticed they were in identical warm coats and reindeer fur-lined hats. He and Rolf turned the corner onto the next street. They looked at each other.
"Criminal surveillance," Shymov said. "The militia."
"How did you know?"
"Just a hunch."
"Boy, that was a close call," said Rolf. "Do you still like personal meetings?"
"Sure. Now, where were we?"
The Tropel cameras Shymov had used in return to Rolf were carried by hand back to the United States. Meanwhile, the tape recording of Shymov's answers in Russian about cryptology was translated in the station by Gilshire. When the film was developed, with more than 100 pages of information and the answers translated, an urgent message arrived at the Moscow station. Shymov was for real. The intelligence was sensitive. The Soviets would never have used it for a dangle, and extremely important. The Soviet Union was installing new encrypted communications equipment around the world. Shymov could unlock those messages. Rolf had told Shymov that exfiltration might take 12 to 18 months, but now there was a fresh urgency. The National Security Agency wanted him brought to the United States fast. Shymov had given the Americans a tantalizing taste of his material, but he possessed much more. He knew the clock was ticking. The longer he was in Moscow, the greater the chance he would be discovered. Also, the size of what he wanted to deliver to the United States was too large to be transmitted in any dead drop or other means in Moscow. To damage the Soviet Union and save himself, he had no choice but to defect. The CIA and the National Security Agency also realized the information Shymov possessed would be immensely valuable as long as the Soviet Union did not know it was missing. Once discovered, the Soviets might change the codes. So they had to get Shymov out without the KGB knowing he had gone to the United States, at least for as long as possible. In the Moscow station, Rolf reached for the files marked CK Go. Not only did he get his first operation, but it was to be one of the most audacious ever attempted. At their third meeting, Shymov delivered photographs of his family that the CIA could use for preparing documents and the other information Rolf had asked for. The biggest hurdle for the exfiltration was Shymov's young daughter. Two adults could remain silent for the 45 minutes or so it would take to smuggle them across the border in a van. But a 4-year-old girl? How to keep her quiet? Rolf secured from the CIA 5 samples of sedatives suitable for a small child. He was worried. He thought for sure Shymov would refuse to take them. Rolf had a daughter about the same age, and he would never have given her any pills from the KGB. But, to his surprise, Shymov agreed. Shymov gave the CIA carefully hand-drawn charts on his daughter's breathing and pulse each time she took a tablet. They selected one sedative for the exfiltration. The Moscow station had conducted 5 meetings with Shymov over a period of about 10 weeks. The pace was unprecedented. Although he preferred personal meetings, Shymov signaled at one point that he wanted to use a special kind of dead drop, known as a foot-timed drop, in which the package is left by the agent and picked up by the case officer in short order. Rolf saw the first signal, then waited for the second signal that the drop had been filled before he went out on an evening walk. He retrieved Shymov's package intact and took it to the station the next morning. Among other things, he found an ops note from Shymov tucked into a small glass bottle with a stopper, about 2 inches high. Rolf thought that Shymov was being extremely careful, putting the note in the bottle to keep it dry. But actually, Shymov had another purpose in mind. The label on the bottle said it held 50 tablets of extract of valerian, an herb for soothing nerves. He intended it as a signal to Rolf that all was going well and not to worry. No one in the station grasped the implication. The final days had arrived. Shymov was supposed to check a lamppost in Moscow for a signal from the CIA that all was ready to go. He and Olga rode a streetcar to the location, careful to be looking casual and not staring at each passing lamppost. But when they reached the stop, they realized all the lampposts had been ripped down for a construction project.
"What do we do now?" Olga asked him.
"We go," Shymov said. "I think at this point it would be more dangerous for us to wait than to try."
He sounded more confident than he felt. The plan was to take a train to a secluded, forested point between Leningrad and the border with Finland, from which the CIA would whisk them out, hidden in a vehicle. The date was May 17, 1980. The operation was extremely sensitive. The White House knew about it, but had instructed Gerber not to inform the U.S. ambassador at the time, Thomas Watson, Jr. If the plan fell apart, all the blame would be laid on the CIA. But everyone in the station knew about it. The case officers had all contributed to the elaborate plan. Rolf wanted to wait around the station that Saturday for word of what had happened, but Gerber said it made no sense. He did not want to alert the KGB to any unusual activity. Gerber told the communicator on duty that he was expecting a message about an operation. If the operation was a success, the communicator should put a piece of paper with a large handwritten numeral 1 on the inner door to the station, the one that looked like a bank vault with a combination on it. If a failure, he said, write a 0. Late on Saturday afternoon, Gerber went to the embassy building, ostensibly to pick out a film to watch at home that night. He briefly opened the outer door of the station and looked at the inner door. A big 1 was taped to the door. Shymov was out. The flight of CK Utopia was over. Moreover, Shymov had left behind clues to throw off the KGB. For months, they thought he had been murdered along with his family, although they could not find proof. Rolf's operation was brief but highly successful. A few months later, when Rolf was back in the United States, he met Shymov again at a temporary safe house in Northern Virginia. They embraced. Shymov said to Rolf, "The whole time we were meeting, I wasn't really sure whether you were actually CIA. The one thing that proved to me you were CIA and not KGB is when you gave me those medicines to test on my daughter. Because the KGB is heartless, they would have given me one pill and said, 'Do it.' I knew I was working with a humane organization when you gave me 5 medicines." Now Rolf was ready for his next assignment, Adolf Tolkachev. Chapter 11. Going Black. Late in the afternoon of October 14, 1980, David Rolf walked out of the Moscow station and went home. An hour later, he returned to the embassy gate with his wife, dressed as if going to a dinner party. A Soviet militiaman, standing guard in a small shack outside the embassy, saw them enter. Rolf and his wife vanished into the building, navigating the narrow corridors to one of the apartments. The door was already ajar. Rolf pushed it open. They whispered not a word. The apartment belonged to the deputy technical operations officer in the Moscow station. an espionage jack-of-all-trades who helped case officers with equipment and concealments, from sophisticated radio scanners to fake logs. The Moscow station had two, the chief and his deputy. They had been highly trained by the CIA, similar to the case officers, but with different skills. They usually did not run agents on the street. 3 days out of four, the chief tech officer had no surveillance, and when he did have it, he tried to build the familiar patterns of activity that case officers believed the KGB would grow accustomed to. He stuck to very unremarkable routines, visiting stores and garages, foraging for supplies, repeating the same trips day after day. Sure enough, the KGB's interest waned. Yet the techs were an essential part of the station's espionage operations. The deputy tech motioned wordlessly to Rolf after he entered the apartment. The men were approximately the same height and physique. In total silence, Rolf began to transform himself to look like his host. The deputy tech had long, messy hair. Rolf put on a wig with long, messy hair. The deputy had a full beard. Rolf put on a full beard. The deputy tech helped Rolf adjust and secure the disguise, then fitted him with the SRR-100, a radio scanner, antenna, and earpiece to monitor KGB transmissions on the street. The earpiece was made by the Swiss hearing aid company, Phonak, and it was the most delicate part. Disguised with a CIA-developed color-matched silicon to replicate the inner ear's contours and shadows. Rolf heard a voice boom from the doorway. It was the chief tech officer, who had just arrived and was deliberately speaking loudly, assuming they were being overheard by KGB listening devices. "Hey, are we going to go and check out that new machine shop?" the chief asked. The real deputy replied aloud, "Great, let's go." But the real deputy did not leave the apartment. The man who left the apartment, looking like him, was David Rolf. The real deputy pulled up a chair and settled in for a long wait. Rolf's wife, in her dinner dress, also sat down and would remain there for the next 6 hours. They could not utter a word because the KGB might be listening, and an elaborate deception was underway. The identity transfer had begun. Rolf was off to meet Tolkachev for the first time, if he could get free from surveillance on the streets. The point of the identity transfer was to break through the embassy perimeter and return without being spotted. Rolf knew the KGB was not interested in the two technical officers and usually paid little attention when they drove out of the compound in search of food, flowers, or car parts in an old beige and green Volkswagen van. On this night, the van pulled out of the embassy at dusk. The chief tech was at the wheel, Rolf in the passenger seat. The van windows were dirty. The militiamen just shrugged. It looked like the two supply guys on the prowl again. Once on the street, the van took a slow, irregular course. The chief tech knew the city well, because he had less surveillance and was out driving often. Rolf scanned the street, looking for signs they were being followed. The chief tech also had a practiced eye for surveillance and kept a close watch on the rearview mirror. They searched for cars with the telltale triangle of dirt on the grill, left there by the KGB car wash. They looked for panel trucks, idling for no reason. The KGB had many ways to confuse them, including a reclining seat to conceal one of the officers, and a switch in unmarked cars that could turn off just one headlight, so the same car would look different on a second sighting. Rolf thought to himself that he had one advantage. He was the orchestra director. He was the only one who knew where he was going. Everything they might do was in reaction to him. Normal drivers would pay no attention to the VW van. At a stoplight, they would pull right up alongside or behind. Rolf was watching for something that a normal car wouldn't do. If there was a stoplight, why did the third car behind them pull in behind a bus? That was an indicator. And Rolf was collecting them, sifting, processing what he saw. In departing the embassy in disguise, he was playing a game entirely based on deception. His goal was not to be noticed as he slipped out. But over the next few hours, he would gradually unfold a new approach. he would become more open and teasing. He would try to flush out the KGB. Ultimately, his mission was to get black, to completely shake the surveillance. But getting black required a long, exhausting test of nerves, even before he would get his first chance to look Tolkachev in the eyes. On a surveillance detection run, the case officer had to be as agile as a ballet dancer, as confounding as a magician, and as attentive as an air traffic flight controller. Rolf had drilled in the CIA training courses, and he knew from his early days in Army intelligence how important it was to absorb the lessons of those drills, mastering a sense of time and distance, exploiting the optics of moving through the gap. Rolf also planned meticulously, avoiding the hotspots and hidden cameras on the Moscow streets. Once, he was in the middle of a 4-hour-long surveillance detection run and thought he was black. All of a sudden, official-looking Zhiguli and Volga cars were whipping around turns and speeding back and forth. Rolf cursed to himself, "I've just walked into a beehive." He later discovered he had happened upon an obscure KGB training academy in the middle of a practice session. The Moscow station kept track of the known hotspots with red pushpins on the city map so they could avoid them. In his last review of the plan with Gerber, hours earlier in the Moscow station, Rolf went over the route, the contingencies, each turn, each cover stop. What Rolf remembered was how Gerber treated every operation as if it were his own. He thought of the smallest details, body language, gestures, appearances, and illusions. Rolf once thought he'd never find another chief of station like Gus Hathaway, the tireless operator. Then he worked for Gerber, an intense, precise choreographer of espionage. The van stopped at a flower shop. Rolf remained in his seat. Buying flowers was a routine, their first cover stop, a pause to see if the surveillance cars or foot patrol teams would get careless and stumble over themselves. Rolf kept his disguise on, in case they were questioned, but did not go into the flower shop, knowing that the harsh white light could expose the imperfections. Better to remain veiled behind the dirty window in the van. The first cover stop had an important function, the abort option. If there was surveillance, Rolf could always break off here and go home with minimal losses. The KGB would have no inkling that he was headed to a meeting with an agent. By experience, Rolf had learned it was always best to catch the KGB at the start of a run, when they were more easily detected. If you saw the same red car 3 times, that was a clue. But as time passed, detection became more difficult. If the KGB was suspicious, they could throw more cars and more teams into the hunt. This made Moscow different from other cities. Rolf had the advantage in knowing where he was going, but the KGB had limitless resources they could devote to the chase if they became suspicious. They could put 12 cars on his tail, and he would not see the same one twice. The first part of a surveillance detection run was always in a moving vehicle for more control. In the VW van, Rolf and the chief tech enjoyed nearly 360-degree vision and plenty of agility. They could accelerate, forcing the KGB watchers to keep up and perhaps reveal themselves. Or they could make abrupt U-turns, perhaps coming face-to-face with the surveillance car, if it existed. The KGB always sent out teams of 3 and 4 cars, so the goal was to trip them up, maneuver so they would have to show their presence early. Time and distance could be leveraged to Rolf's advantage. It was a lesson that Haviland Smith and his peers had discovered in the 1960s. After 1.5 hours of driving, darkness had settled over the city, and Rolf began a mental countdown. His next move required a decision based on what he had seen and his instincts. The rule of thumb was to advance to the next stage only if he was 95% certain he was black. The reason was simple. He had the upper hand in the car. On foot and alone, he would be much more vulnerable. Rolf had known case officers who could not cross this threshold. They would feel surveillance, even if they had not seen it, and turn back. They were never criticized for this. It might have been a good call. But the decision to go ahead, to take the risk of a meeting with an agent, was much harder. The agent's life was at risk. Rolf weighed what he had seen on the darkening streets. He was 95% sure he was free from surveillance. He looked to the chief tech, who agreed. While the van was still moving, Rolf quickly slipped off the disguise and put it into a small sack on the floor. He grabbed the shopping bag that had been prepared for Tolkachev and slipped into a woolen coat. The van stopped very briefly. Rolf slid out and walked briskly away. The chief tech went to look for a quiet place to hide the van and take a walk in the park. Soon, Rolf reappeared on another broad avenue a few blocks away, and he walked directly into a crowd waiting for one of the electric trolley buses that prowled Moscow's major arteries. He boarded the trolley at the rear door. To an outsider, Rolf resembled just another tired worker going home, standing wearily, squeezed in tightly. But in reality, he was watching every move around him. No one on the bus could see it, but the small radio device in his ear was wirelessly connected to a receiver about the size of a thin cigarette pack, held in the pocket of a white cotton harness that wrapped around his chest. A necklace of wire served as antenna and also handled the connection to the earpiece. In earlier years, case officers had to rather clumsily plug in crystals that might pick up a KGB transmission, and it was hit or miss. But Rolf was wearing a new model that scanned multiple KGB bands automatically. It gave him a leg up on the KGB. He could listen to them as they talked to each other. The downside was that it was so sensitive that it picked up squelches, jibs, and jabs of a dozen or more surveillance teams that could be three-quarters of a mile away and may not be following him or even know about him. The radio was a wonder of concealment and smarts, but it was a secondary tool. It could provide warning of surveillance, but not prove Rolf was free from it. Confirming that he was free from surveillance was the single most critical factor in what he was about to do. Rolf scanned the trolley passengers, taking careful note of those who boarded with him. Then he abruptly stepped toward the door and jumped off at the next stop, watching to see who followed. So far, nothing seemed out of place. On foot, he began the final stage of the surveillance detection run. Rolf was physically fit, and his head was clear, but his year in Moscow had taught him that surveillance detection runs were grueling. The late autumn weather felt raw, moist, and heavy. After he spent hours walking in the open air, his lungs ached. His mouth grew dry, but there was nowhere he could safely stop. Every doorway or public space could be a trap, and Rolf knew that the KGB peered down at sidewalks and streets from telescopes mounted in windows above. They had thousands of people watching. The radio scanner was quiet, but for the usual patter and static. At a small theater, Rolf pivoted on his heel and pushed open the doors. This was his second cover stop. He checked out the playboard and notices on the wall without saying anything. He almost never came to this theater. He listened intently to the radio, but heard nothing. His goal was to force the KGB men to do something out of character, to slip, so that he could spot them before they could call in reinforcements and blanket the streets. Rolf left the theater with tickets for a show he had no intention to attend. The real show was coming up soon. The theater had triggered no sign of surveillance. The next cover stop would certainly send the KGB into fits, should they see him. Rolf avoided the metro. There were monitoring cameras inside most stations, and walked toward an antique store, far from his usual routines. He had been there once before, with his family, but he would never go to an antique store alone at night during the week. The point was to ramp up his challenge to the KGB, forcing them to act. Still nothing. He walked into a nearby apartment building and started climbing the stairs. This would trigger a KGB ambush if they were following him. They could not allow him to disappear from sight in a multi-floor apartment building. In fact, Rolf had nowhere to go in the building, and knew not a soul who lived there. He was just trying to provoke the KGB. At a landing on the stairs, he sat down and waited. No one came running up the stairs. Rolf turned around. For 3.5 hours, the KGB had been nowhere in sight. Still, to make sure, he walked to a small park near the apartment building. The park was lined with benches. Tall apartment buildings loomed on all sides, leaving the benches in darkness. Rolf hoped that his presence in the park, so far from home or the embassy, would raise hackles, and if nearby, the KGB would leap out and grab him. Better to face them now than to take them to Tolkachev. He carried no passport, no identification, but he did not fear being caught. He could explain being in a park, and they would be no wiser. But he must not lead the KGB to Tolkachev. Rolf looked at his watch. He was 12 minutes from the meeting site. Time to go. He was 100% sure. He rose from the bench. Suddenly, he was jolted by a squelch in his earpiece, then another, and a third. They were loud, clearly from the KGB surveillance teams. Rolf didn't know why. Did they see him stand up? He stood frozen, rigid, tense. The squelch could sometimes be used as a signal, without words, from one KGB man to another. But the noise could also have been related to something else, on a street a half mile away. It could have been a ham-fisted operator who hit his button by mistake. Rolf often repeated the words, "When you're black," in his mind. It meant that when you are black, you can do anything, because nobody is watching you. Nothing. No sign of anyone in the park. Rolf let his shoulders drop and took a deep breath. When you're black, you're black. Rolf circled the meeting site once on foot, still alert to any signs of surveillance. The site was designated Olga, not far from the German embassy. He recalled the scare over those two men he'd seen in the playground sandbox on that first night with Shymov 6 months earlier. But he saw nothing. Rolf thought it was a good place for a meeting, with a few apartment buildings, some low-lying shabby garages, not many people on the street. Then he spotted Tolkachev. Rolf had read the entire file and was briefed by Gilscher. He felt that he would recognize Tolkachev upon seeing him the first time and imagined a warm hello face to face. But now Rolf was walking behind a man who was shuffling along. He looked as if he might be Tolkachev. Rolf had almost overtaken him. The man was stooped a bit. The plan was to exchange greetings, and if the response was correct, Rolf would know he was Tolkachev. Rolf was uncertain what to do. He might be looking at the wrong man, but there was no harm in using the greeting. If it was the wrong man, the Russian would probably just look quizzically at him and ask what the hell he was talking about. From behind, Rolf said out loud, "Privyet od Kati," or "Hello" from Katya. The man turned around and said clearly, "Peredajte privyet od Borisa," or "Send regards from Boris." That was the coded answer. Rolf smiled slightly, looked at Tolkachev, and extended his hand. Tolkachev shook it. He was wearing a black jacket and a brimmed cap, and seemed even smaller than Rolf had anticipated, no more than 5 feet 6 inches tall. His face was chiseled, the nose aquiline, but Rolf noticed it was dented at the top. Rolf's watch said 9 p.m. It was Tolkachev's 8th meeting with the CIA. Rolf knew that his most important goal at this moment was simply to build the kind of trust that Tolkachev had in Gilscher. He kept his first remarks light and reassuring, and he gave Tolkachev an ops note that he had painstakingly drafted in the Moscow station. He noticed right away that Tolkachev did not respond emotionally. His face was impassive. Then Rolf delivered some good news. Tolkachev's special request for the suicide pill had been approved by the CIA in response to his written appeal in June. Gerber had pushed headquarters. "What we must not do," Gerber insisted, "is allow this question to dominate the operation.
and we are frankly concerned that the longer the giving of the special request is delayed, that is what we are going to face.
At the news, Tolkachev finally seemed to relax. Rolf said he would deliver the pill at their next meeting. The CIA could put it into a pen or something else that Tolkachev normally carried in his pocket. The Moscow station had been fretting over the choice of concealment. It had to be good enough so it could never be discovered, but easy enough to carry in case of dire emergency. When Rolf asked about it, Tolkachev replied indifferently, saying he didn't have a preference. In the ops note, Rolf said of the suicide pill, "I can only hope that it will give you the peace of mind you desire." In the note, Rolf also gave Tolkachev a list of questions to answer that would help in planning for exfiltration, such as clothing and shoe sizes, what medicines he and his family used, what cities or places they were permitted to visit, and when they would go on vacation. Tolkachev was apologetic. In the summer months, it was harder for him to sneak documents out of the institute because he didn't wear an overcoat. He had photographed only 25 rolls of film since the last meeting with Gilscher in June. He passed them to Rolf, along with a 9-page note. Tolkachev was still very worried about the library permission sheet, which carried his signature for so many top-secret documents. He knew it would incriminate him, and he offered a new idea. Earlier, he suggested that the CIA fabricate his building pass in order to defeat the security procedures. Now, he wondered, could the CIA also fabricate a copy of his library permission sheet with just a few signatures? He could find a way to substitute the fake sheet for the real one. Tolkachev handed to Rolf some written diagrams and notes and a photograph to help the CIA make a copy of it. The minutes were ticking away, but Tolkachev had more to say. He told Rolf he had purchased a car, a small ochre-colored Zhiguli, the Soviet everyman car modeled on the boxy Italian Fiat. Tolkachev wanted to use the car for future meetings. They might be able to talk for a longer stretch without being detected. Who would suspect two friends sitting in a car? Tolkachev told Rolf briefly that he was still unhappy with the money the CIA was giving him and promised to write about it later. He reminded the CIA of his patience, however, in the letter he handed to Rolf. "I only want to note one more time," he wrote, "that the gradual and dragged-out approach from your side to the questions of finances does not affect the general process of my cooperation with you." 15 minutes had already passed, and Tolkachev had one more request. He handed Rolf a piece of paper. When Rolf looked down, he saw it was printed in English, in block letters. 1. Led Zeppelin. 2. Pink Floyd. 3. Genesis. 4. Alan Parsons Project. 5. Emerson, Lake and Palmer. 6. Uriah Heep. 7. The Who. 8. The Beatles. 9. The Yes. 10. Rich Wakeman. 11. Nazareth. 12. Alice Cooper. Tolkachev wanted the CIA to obtain rock music albums for his son Oleg. He had copied the names down by hand, although he apparently did not know them well. "My son, as many of his contemporaries in school, has a passion for Western music," Tolkachev wrote. "Besides, I too, in spite of my age, like to listen to this music." He said the records were only available on the black market, but, "I do not want to use the black market, because you can always end up in an unpredictable situation." He added that the list was to indicate the tastes of my son. But he wanted the most popular musical groups in the West, including the USA. Rolf was nervous because of the squelch he had heard in the park before the meeting. He knew that he and Tolkachev had been together only briefly, but decided to cut the meeting short. Tolkachev did not object. They shook hands and parted. Rolf walked away quickly. At this hour in the city, there were not many people on the streets. Rolf returned to the parked VW van, which was waiting for him at a rendezvous point. The chief tech had taken a small surveillance detection run of his own before arriving at the point, just to make sure the KGB was not waiting for them. Once in the van, Rolf gave a thumbs up, wordlessly. The tech reached down to the floor and grabbed a bottle of beer for each of them, a small ritual at the end of every run. He was so cold, the beers had nearly frozen. They snapped off the tops, and Rolf, his throat dry from hours on the street, savored the icy beer. Then he put on the beard and wig, and they drove back to the embassy. The last feint in the identity transfer deception was important. They had to close the loop, crossing back into the embassy undetected. The guards didn't give them a second glance. The gate opened, and Rolf's run was over. A little while later, the Soviet militiamen in the shack took note that David Rolf and his wife left the embassy dinner party for home. Chapter 12. Devices and Desires. At last, Tolkachev would get his suicide pill. It arrived at the Moscow station by the regular secure delivery a few weeks after the October meeting, in a package about the size of a cigar box. Rolf opened it. Nestled inside was the fountain pen with the L pill, held in place by foam inserts, cut in the shape of a pistol. He gingerly examined the pen, then put it back and locked the box in a file drawer. Soon after, headquarters sent a cable with instructions in Russian on how to extract the fragile capsule from inside the pen and bite down on it. In the close-knit Moscow station, everyone shared everything. In Gerber's small office, they talked over plans for a surveillance detection run and new meeting sites they had cased the previous weekend. Sometimes they sketched on a chalkboard or rehearsed how they would handle a phone call in Russian with an agent. In advance of a major operation, wives would join them in the cramped station, sitting on the desks and floor, double-checking disguises and packages, examining maps and routes. When Rolf told the others about Tolkachev's request for Western rock music for his son, they nodded knowingly. They'd seen it all over Moscow. Young people yearning for consumer goods from the West. Cassettes for tape recorders. Magazines. Nail polish and remover. Polaroid cameras. Scotch tape. T-shirts with English lettering. Turtleneck sweaters. Running shoes. And countless other things they could not find at home. Tolkachev had also requested a catalog of Western stereo equipment. Why not give it to him? It seemed like such an inconsequential favor for an agent who was delivering massive volumes of intelligence. But Gerber was cold-eyed and not immediately swayed. What if Tolkachev, leading designer at a top-secret Soviet military research institute, was seen by a neighbor carrying albums by Uriah Heep? Or what if the records were spotted in his apartment? Wouldn't that look suspicious? Rolf wrote to headquarters that sudden acquisition of the records might raise eyebrows and demand uncomfortable explanations. He added, "We know that records of the type he has requested are occasionally available in Moscow on the black market, but the cost is generally high. If we knew his son already had a sizable collection, adding a few more, cut by European companies, would probably do little harm. We would not, however, want to be his son's sole supplier." The stereo catalog might be easier to hide, he added, but how his son might handle this windfall is a big unknown. Would Tolkachev next ask them for a turntable and speakers? The tussle over the L pill was still fresh in everyone's mind. The Moscow station did not want to reject such a simple request from Tolkachev, but they were worried about his security. They decided to pause, tell Tolkachev of their concern in December, and ask him how the records would be handled and stored. If Tolkachev could obtain a reel-to-reel tape player, they thought, the CIA might provide the music on tapes. That would be harder to trace. Day after day, with his Pentax camera clamped to the back of a chair, Tolkachev copied documents. The rolls of 35mm film he gave to Rolf in October produced 920 frames containing 817 pages. Soon, headquarters was pressing Moscow for more at the behest of the customers of intelligence, primarily the Air Force, the Navy, the National Security Agency, and the Defense Intelligence Agency. When he met Gilscher in 1979, Tolkachev had turned over 5 circuit boards from the RP-23 radar project and schematic drawings to go with them. The schematics were rushed to headquarters for translation, and the electronics sent elsewhere for inspection and analysis. Now, in the fall of 1980, headquarters wanted Rolf to ask Tolkachev for some additional circuit boards or pieces of electronic equipment. The military customers were becoming insatiable, Rolf thought. He worried they were pushing so hard they might endanger Tolkachev's security. Rolf had always respected the logic in Tolkachev's method, removing documents, then returning them the same day. Nobody was the wiser once the papers were safely back in the files. But hardware was another story. If a piece of hardware was missing, because it could not be replaced, an internal investigation would most certainly result. This demand for electronics and spare parts could sink them. Gerber resisted a suggestion from headquarters that they give Tolkachev a wish list of electronic parts. Just because Tolkachev had passed a piece of equipment one time in the past does not shed any light on his continued access, his ability to remove such equipment safely, or the degree of risk involved, he wrote. If they pressed Tolkachev for more spare parts, Gerber added, he might consider that we are squeezing him, and consequently become either more demanding or more difficult. Or, Gerber speculated, Tolkachev might get reckless and take chances to steal more circuit boards, endangering his security. Armed with a list of specific material requirements, CKS is type of person who may manufacture transparent and dangerously insecure means to procure the items. Gerber suggested that they simply ask Tolkachev at the next meeting whether he could get his hands on any more electronics, and added, "We believe it is of major importance to ensure that Tolkachev does nothing to harm his security." On Monday, December 8, 1980, at 8:25 p.m., Rolf went to see Tolkachev in a wooded park at the Moscow Zoo, located near Tolkachev's apartment building. Tolkachev often passed the zoo while walking to work. They had planned the meeting months earlier, and Rolf wanted to stick to the schedule, even though superpower hostility seemed to be ratcheting up again. On November 4th, Ronald Reagan had been elected 40th President of the United States. Then, in early December, there had been a scare over a possible Soviet invasion of Poland. In the end, Soviet troops didn't cross the border, but the Moscow station was braced for heavy KGB surveillance. Rolf was determined to go ahead with the meeting. "Just get it right on the street," Gerber told Rolf. That night, the park seemed empty. Rolf intended to spend more time with Tolkachev than he had during the hurried meeting in October. Rolf carried with him a shopping bag, typical for any Russian on the street, with parcels wrapped to look like ordinary purchases of a Muscovite on the lookout for food and goods. Tolkachev seemed relaxed. They strolled in the park like two old friends. Rolf was listening for surveillance on his SRR-100 radio, but heard nothing. His eyes scanned the park for unwanted attention, but all was quiet. The park was so close to Tolkachev's apartment tower that Rolf could see it rise above the tree line. Rolf reached into his shopping bag and gave Tolkachev the wrapped pen. Inside was the L pill and the instructions. "This is what you wanted, the means for self-destruction," he said. He did not see the point of emphasizing once again that he hoped Tolkachev would never have to use it. Tolkachev looked pleased that at last he had the suicide pill in his pocket. Rolf asked him to examine the concealment at some later date and tell the CIA if he wanted something different from a fountain pen. The CIA's technical division had worked for months to replicate the library permission sheet and the building pass for Tolkachev. Rolf gave Tolkachev the fakes based on the drawings and photographs Tolkachev had provided in October. It was too dark to see them, but Rolf asked Tolkachev to examine them and report back later. The CIA had replicated the library permission sheet with just a few signatures. The fake building pass was not as urgent, but Rolf still hoped it might prove useful. He also remembered to bring batteries for Tolkachev's Pentax camera, small flat discs that were scarce in Moscow. Tolkachev was delighted. Rolf felt that his reaction said a lot about the man. Tolkachev was intent on photographing as much as possible, and the batteries would allow him to keep working without interruption. Worried about Tolkachev's security, Rolf proposed some new procedures. On the day of a planned meeting, he said, Tolkachev must first signal he was ready by turning on the light in his kitchen between 12:15 and 1 p.m. The Moscow station would send someone out, maybe one of the wives, to check. The signal was codenamed Svet, or light, and visible from the street. If the light was off, the CIA would not come to a meeting. Rolf also gave Tolkachev new plans for an emergency call-out, once a month, to be used for an impromptu meeting only if absolutely necessary. It was dangerous, but if Tolkachev had urgent developments or faced a real threat, it might be worth the risk. Rolf also suggested they set up a signal site at a market near the zoo. When Tolkachev's car was parked in a designated spot by the market at a preordained hour, it would indicate he was ready for a meeting. For the first time, Rolf described to Tolkachev the capability of Discus, the CIA's agent communications device. He explained that the handheld units would allow them to send burst messages on the street while standing some distance away from each other, say several hundred meters apart. The device gave them a way to pass intelligence wordlessly and without actually meeting each other. Tolkachev brightened at the prospect of using it. Rolf said he would attempt to have Discus ready for the next meeting. As they walked, Rolf asked Tolkachev whether he could get more circuit boards or electronic parts like those he gave to Gilscher a year earlier. Would it even be possible? Was it safe? Instead of brushing off the request as Rolf assumed he might, Tolkachev said matter-of-factly that it was possible. He asked Rolf if the CIA could prepare a list. As it happened, Rolf already had one, sent from headquarters in the weeks before, and he gave it to Tolkachev. Rolf didn't ask him to look at it. They could barely see in the dark. Rolf then spoke to Tolkachev about the CIA's worries over the rock music, approaching it gently, not wanting to trigger any anger or disappointment. If the albums were discovered, Rolf said, he was afraid they could get Tolkachev into trouble. How would he explain them? Are they available on the black market? Where do you plan to keep them? Will you have to hide them from friends and visitors to the apartment? Would your son's friends start asking uncomfortable questions? Tolkachev grew animated, and his eyes flashed self-confidence. He told Rolf that he would have no difficulty explaining the presence of the albums in his apartment. They are all available on the black market in Moscow, he explained, but he was personally reluctant to go there. Tolkachev said he would accept the music on tape if necessary, and told Rolf he already owned a Hitachi cassette player, about 3 years old, which he had purchased at a Komissonia magazine, a store where people could sell their possessions on consignment, usually clothes, but occasionally electronics. Time was running out. Tolkachev gave Rolf a 10-page handwritten note, in which he proposed to finally settle the issue of his compensation. At the last minute, Rolf remembered there was an urgent question from headquarters. In August 1980, the United States had revealed the existence of stealth technology, making airplanes nearly invisible to radar. What did Tolkachev know about the Soviet response to the American stealth airplanes? And was there a Soviet stealth? Tolkachev said he had heard of the invisible airplane, but didn't know the answer, and didn't want to pass on information to Rolf about which he was uncertain. They had been walking for 20 minutes. Rolf reached into his bag and pulled out two slender books in Russian, as New Year's gifts from the CIA. One was a tract by Andrei Sakharov, the nuclear physicist turned dissident, whom Tolkachev admired. The other was a thin volume by Anatoly Fedosayev, a prominent Soviet radar and electronics designer who had developed the vacuum tubes that were used in land-based radars that ringed the Soviet Union. Fedosayev had received the highest state awards, including Hero of Socialist Labor and the Lenin Prize. He went to France in May 1971 as a ranking member of a Soviet delegation to the Paris Air Show, then defected to the United Kingdom. His disillusionment with the Soviet system